Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Ellen Alezik.
And today we'll be talking about John M. Chu's big screen adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights and Ben Wheatley's pandemic folk horror In the Earth. We'll also get the inside track on In the Earth from actor Reese Shearsmith, and in Film Club, with Monster Hunter in cinemas, we're reanimating Paul W.S. Anderson's zombie action sequel, Resident Evil Retribution. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, David. Always a pleasure.
Good to see you.
And Eleanor, it's been a while.
I know.
How have you been?
I've missed you all. Yeah, I've been great. I mean, I've been at home already, starting to go back outside. I've been to the cinema a couple of times, so can't complain.
Mm-hmm. So we're using this revamp of Truth in Movies as a way of reintroducing all of our regular guests to the great wide world. So can you tell us, who are you? What do you do? What have you been up to recently?
I'm a freelance film critic. I'm French, in case you couldn't hear that. I didn't use this pandemic to do this, but the pandemic sort of prompted me to finally do something I'd been wanting to do for a while, which is launch my own film magazine. It's an online film magazine, and it launched like last week, I think. Maybe I think it was last week, yes. But I've been basically working on it, or at least thinking about it for the whole pandemic. So it's been pretty intense, kept me busy. It's going really well. It's called Animus.
Mm-hmm. And that's online. We can check it out. Writing by Charles Promesco, Sophie Mertz Kaufman, yeah. People whose voices may be familiar mm-hmm. to listeners.
Only the best.
And what's the website for that?
The website is animusmagazine.com.
So later on, we're talking about Resident Evil Retribution with a bit of a video game spin. I must ask, this is a nerdy question. Animus, of course, is in the Assassin's Creed games and the film of the games.
Yes,
any influence there?
I have actually seen the Assassin's Creed film. I have not played the games. I really want to, actually. But no, it doesn't really come from that. I saw also that Animus is something in Doctor Who as well, I was informed. But no, it just comes from the Latin word Animus, which I guess is also where it comes from for Doctor Who and Assassin's Creed. But if people can like relate to it in that way too, it's not a problem, you know.
If they come across it thinking it's like Assassin's Creed fandom, but then find a load of awesome film criticism, that's no bad thing, really.
Exactly. I like to think there's probably, you know, a Venn diagram of people who like both things, you know.
Yeah. So lots more video game related chat later in the episode. This is a packed episode. We have the usual two new releases and Film Club, but also an interview with Reese Shearsmith. So stay tuned for that if you're a fan of him and his work. But we should kick things off on a high with In the Heights. So, John M. Chu, director of Crazy Rich Asians, adapts the hit musical from Lin-Manuel Miranda that centres on the New York neighbourhood of Washington Heights, where a kaleidoscope of dreams rallies the vibrant and tight-knit community. At the intersection of it all is the likeable, magnetic bodega owner, Usnavi, played by Anthony Ramos, who saves every penny from his daily grind as he hopes, imagines, and sings about a better life. David, what better way to welcome the reopening of cinemas than with a big, big musical? Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the talk around this film has kind of harked back to this almost post-war ideal of, like, you know, after this lengthy period of kind of boredom and awfulness and having to sort of isolate and be away from human contact, that, you know, the movie musical is returning to its kind of primal form as the kind of the thing that brings communities together and makes it and reminds us of the joy of life again. And you definitely can kind of feel that, like, that was part of the impetus of getting this film out right now, as the kind of the restrictions are being drawn back and people are able to kind of interact with the world once more. It is like, I mean, Sugar High doesn't quite touch it. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, toxic tartrazine, full body blood transfusion style. Like, it's very, very, very kind of, it's putting joy right into your face. So, and I definitely don't mean that in a kind of negative way. It's the story of a Dominican immigrant in New York's Washington Heights, and he is our kind of narrator. It's called Usnavi. And he's played really well by Anthony Ramos, who is already getting a lot of talk about kind of rewards and, you know, destined for great things. And essentially it's his kind of, there are a few little kind of things in there. It's set around the time of the New York blackout, which was a kind of thing that sort of brought communities together in this sort of strange way. But also there's a countdown to his decision to leave New York, return back to the Dominican Republic and start a bar, like restart his father's bar that was destroyed in a storm. And it's very, very kind of, you know, it's very kind of musically. It's Lin-Manuel Miranda, who kind of wrote the original stage version, you can tell that he is a deep scholar of the kind of structure and emotional beats of the musical, because, like, it kind of hits every single one absolutely bang on. I mean, it's, you know, you get the big opening number, then you get a kind of the sort of funny number following that, where you introduce all the side players, and then you get the sort of, like, the questioning number of people, like, being sort of like anxious about their lives, and then you have the kind of sad number, then you have it all coming back together again. So it kind of, it's very formulaic in that way. But again, that's not necessarily a negative thing. So that this is actually my first taste of anything Lin-Manuel Miranda based. And I was a little nervous about that, because I'm not necessarily, I don't think Hamilton, from what I know about what Hamilton is, it's like, I'm happy that people love Hamilton, but it didn't necessarily appeal to me. But yeah, have any of you guys seen Hamilton? And it'd be interesting to know how it compares to this.
I've seen the filmed stage version that went up on Disney Plus last year, almost as a stopgap until I'm sure eventually they turn it into a film. And yeah, it's very Lin-Manuel Miranda, and anyone who's also heard the music he's done for Disney properties like Moana, he has a very specific rhythm of delivery. The interesting thing here is that he played Usnavi; he originated that role on Broadway, and I can't really see Lin-Manuel, you know, charming as much as Anthony Ramos does. Eleanor, were you charmed by this? It definitely is industrial grade musical.
And I mean, I'm glad if people like it, obviously that's their choice. I did not really enjoy In the Heights. I didn't hate it or anything. I was kind of expecting to find it absolutely unbearable or something, because I was once almost like forced to listen to all of Hamilton you know, without the images, just the CD. And I thought I was, you know, dissociating. I just thought it was really horrible. I didn't like it at all. But I mean, I didn't like, I'm sure if I like sat in a room and tried to actually listen to it on my own, maybe I would, you know, develop more of a, you know, appreciation for it, but not in that situation. So I was expecting to not like it at all. And I did like it quite a bit. And especially what I liked most about In the Heights was really the choreography and stuff. Whenever there were loads of people dancing and stuff, I was like, yes, this is why I love, this is not why I love musicals, but this is what some, one of the things that I really, really think is amazing about musicals, you know, and you get swept away and everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. You know? I found quite grating is that it's a musical that's almost entirely sung through, but there's too much talking because the talking is sung through. And it's just people saying things, and like making a little sing song about them. And I have nothing against I don't say that out of like a sort of, you know, the purity of the musical. The musical should just be about songs and not about people saying things, whatever. Like, that's not the point. The point is that I found it quite exhausting to try to keep up with what they were saying about, because it advanced the story every time and advanced, you know, the characterization. And I just found it quite exhausting to listen. And, you know, they sing in this obviously cadenced way, because that's what singing is. But at the same time, you're trying to understand what they're saying, and it was just a bit much for me. And also the film is, I mean, I have nothing against, I think musicals are supposed to be long, so I wasn't surprised about that, but it's just this for 2.5 hours was like quite a lot for me. And yeah, I just find it a bit like there were no songs to me that I found really catchy or that I can even remember, because all the songs were just people saying this is who I am, this is what I want, this is what I dream of, but this happened, and you know, just the story, and it was just too much for me. Like, I don't find that entertaining or pretty to listen to.
It's true, and I think it's a Lin-Manuel Miranda trait. He's so lyrically and melodically dexterous as well. So he likes to really pack his songs with lots and lots of words and dialogue and overlapping voices. So particularly in like the first half hour, where they're doing a lot of setup, like, you know, we do have Usnavi as our central character, but it does fan out with quite an ensemble with all their own hopes and dreams and their own backgrounds and their own family dramas and so on. So it can be quite a lot to take on board, particularly if you're, you know, out of shape as I am in terms of musicals. I tend to have a feeling maybe 10 minutes into a musical of intense claustrophobia, thinking, oh gosh, I'm in this for 2.5 hours and they're gonna be singing at me. I've been cornered by this musical. But I think there is considerable sort of charm a bit behind it as well. David, in the adaptation, John M. Chu is known as quite a big, flashy, glossy director. Do you think he brings much to this film?
Well, I think it's interesting actually, because I think John M. Chu is probably, like, if push comes to shove, probably like would be considered one of the best modern musical directors. His Step Up films that he did, Step Up 2, Step Up 3D, are really great. Like, they're properly brilliant films. And you can, and this almost feels like a kind of cross. This almost feels like a merging of the choreographic and sort of filming side of the Step Up films with the kind of almost soap opera drama of Crazy Rich Asians. So yeah, I think he does it that well. And I think that it's slightly hit and miss. Like, some of it just feels very kind of music video-y. Like, it just sort of feels like extended music video style sometimes. And like, I felt that some of the sort of big dance set pieces, like the one set in the Lido, the outdoor pool, it was a really fun number, but like it didn't really have any structure to it. It was just like, oh, let's get them to do this thing over here, and then we'll move the camera, and then someone else can be doing another thing. And it just felt like a little moments that had been stitched together rather than like a number that had a structure to it. Whereas conversely, I thought the highlight of the film for me was the kind of I'm trying to say this without spoilering, but there's a kind of elder sage character called Claudia, who is kind of looks after Uznavi, who is his kind of spirit guide, and she is the sort of spirit guide for the community as well. She's a bit like in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, which I think a lot of people have compared this to sort of structurally. She's like the kind of mother sister character, kind of, you know, overseeing her neighborhood. And then she has a kind of big number in the middle of the film. And it's amazing. I think it's the one number that I think is actually kind of structured, really original, does some really unique things with the camera, with the music, with the editing, with the choreography, and it's really moving, I thought. So like I kind of like, you know, like there is that thing in classic musicals where you have the, I think sort of touching on what Elena was saying before, there's more of a delineation between like, here's the kind of drama part where we're going to see the intrigues playing out and people talking. And then and then we're just going to hard cut into a musical number or like fast fade into a musical number. So there's quite a delineation between them. Whereas this is more that it's got that kind of operetta feel where, you know, everything is kind of half sung, and hip operetta, I think is the technical term. But like, I think that, yeah, that number felt like a really nice sort of standalone classic musical segment, whereas like some of the others just felt a little bit more kind of music video, like we're just going to segue into a music video and then we're going to go back out again and carry on with the story.
Yeah, you're touching on something there that intrigued me about this as well. I have a feeling that in the Heights would have, on a level of stagecraft, would have been something to see in the theatre, particularly, you know, as you say, it's centred around this blackout sequence, which I can imagine in the closed box of a theatre could be used really well in terms of using darkness and characters bring their own light sources and everything. Whereas when it's a film and it's just more dancing, but this time in half darkness, it doesn't really have that sense of vision maybe behind it. And the sort of low point for me is one where they do try and use some film trickery where a dance sequence between two characters has them dancing up the side of a building with a beautiful skyline as they talk about the New York skyline. It just feels like we've got to do something here that we couldn't do on stage, when really sometimes you can't beat what can be done on stage. And that's a question I'm sure that's hanging over the Hamilton musical, something that has been so excellent and so successful on stage. How would you adapt that? Eleanor, on the basis of In the Heights and your experience being forced to listen to Hamilton, would you be paying to see that film?
I mean, yes, I guess I don't like regret seeing it, obviously. Like I'd recommend seeing every movie, but I think this one is like, you can have a really good time watching In the Heights. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's just I found it a bit exhausting after a while, but maybe not everybody will feel that way. I don't know, I think it's definitely interesting, and I mean, it's definitely refreshing to see, you know, people, Latino people and other people from Washington Heights actually on screen. Like, I don't necessarily know, you know, their history, their stories and stuff, and not that cinema has to be used for this purpose, but it is refreshing, and it is kind of interesting, and to find out about the neighborhood, because I don't know anything about it. So yeah, I would recommend seeing it. Yeah, definitely.
Should we put some scores on this to wrap things up? So David, let's go for in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect.
I'm probably going to say 3s across the board, because I was a bit like I didn't have any kind of take on Lin-Manuel beforehand, so I didn't, you know, I was coming at it quite sort of naked in that sense. Then in just enjoyment, yeah, I thought it was very like an enjoyable romp, that kind of thing, you know. And yeah, to echo Elena, I think maybe it has that extra layer of interest in that you know, you are, it is a, there is a more kind of ethnically like diverse story, and you know, you're actually kind of looking into a kind of cultural enclave, even though slightly kind of rose-tinted one. But the fact that, you know, it's kind of rare to have like big musicals with like casting fully of like, you know, Latino people, and to represent a Latino community, because I mean, musicals in particular, you know, I think are quite sort of naughty for using, for sort of having you know, white people play Chinese people or things like that, you know. So this was really interesting to see this, although this has spawned a big kind of cultural debate about about representation and how it maybe didn't go far enough, which is kind of online at the moment. And actually Lin-Manuel Miranda himself has written a kind of online apology about not having taken that casting process to a level that actually shows the community in an even truer light, looking at kind of Afro-Latin community as well. And yeah, three, I mean, it's the sort of thing that I would sort of, yeah, I wouldn't be rushing to watch again, but I think it's if it came on a plane and it was the only option, I wouldn't close my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, we should say that online discourse is really fascinating, and always interesting to read how something that's been positioned by a major studio as a great win for representation does still inspire even more conversation. And there's something about Lin-Manuel Miranda, both this and Hamilton, are being talked of as very Obama era in terms of their themes and the vision of the world they're putting forward. And it's a conversation to have, you know, are they even 10, 15 years on from premiere, out of date? But Eleanor, what are your scores for In the Heights?
I would say maybe 2, 3, 2, so anticipation 2, because of my scarring Hamilton experience. Enjoyment 3, because I did get swept up in it quite a bit, especially the charm of the lead actor, but also Corey Hawkins, who plays his best friend, who I think is really, really charming. I thought he was maybe the highlight of the film. And then 2, because in retrospect, I just, like, I don't remember much of it, and it didn't leave that much of an impression. And it hasn't really changed my opinion of what Lin-Manuel Miranda is doing as art. I don't find it that interesting. But I think it's interesting what you were saying about the representation discourse, because I feel like this is Lin-Manuel Miranda himself positions himself as the man who does perfect representation. And so I think it's totally fair that people respond, actually, no, you know. So I think it's interesting that people are willing to still criticize his work in that way. And I think it's really productive and fruitful. So, yeah.
And hopefully, you know, unfortunately, this film has underperformed in the States, but also the very notion of expecting a film like this to overperform, given the pandemic that's still out there, people still return to cinemas, I think the predictions might have been quite high. Hopefully, this is just another step in a long road, rather than Warner Brothers now saying, well, we're not going to do any more of that.
Oh, yeah.
See how it went down on Twitter. Mm. But it is all part of a very productive and constructive ongoing conversation. But yeah, for me, I'm not a huge musicals fan, so take these scores as you will. But it's, yeah, 3s across the board for me, really. It's not without its pleasures, but I wasn't humming any of the songs the next day.
I just want to add, for anyone out there who's a fan of the musical Rent, that there are quite a few references to Rent in this musical. They're not all very nice to Rent, so I would recommend all Rent heads to check it out and see for themselves.
Just to add, Elena is a Rent head, but maybe that's a subject for another podcast, maybe.
Yes, that would take quite a while to talk about.
So, listeners, any Rent heads out there who do see In the Heights, let us know what you make of In the Heights' response to Rent. It's in cinemas this weekend, but we're going to go from the giddy heights of In the Heights down to the mud and the soil of In the Earth. So, In the Earth. As the world searches for a cure to a disastrous virus, a scientist and park scout venture deep into the forest for a routine equipment run. Through the night, their journey becomes a terrifying voyage through the heart of darkness, the forest coming to life around them. Before we talk about In the Earth, we were very privileged to have some time with actor Reese Shearsmith talking about working with Ben Wheatley, about working on In the Earth under pandemic circumstances, as well as talking a little bit about Inside Number 9. Let's have a listen. Reese Shearsmith, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's such a pleasure to welcome you onto Truth and Movies. Congratulations In the Earth, but also the new series of Inside Number 9. So much great stuff out there at the moment with you, Ian.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
So let's start with the film. This is your third big screen collaboration with Ben Wheatley, and which puts you really firmly in that returning troupe of collaborators. It's such a fun part of following Ben Wheatley's career over the years, seeing the same people on screen, the same names behind the screen. But that's from a fan's perspective. From an actor's perspective, what is it you enjoy about working with Ben that brings you back?
I think we really hit it off. When we first met Ben, I saw Down Terrace as a screening, and then I didn't really meet him then. I just said well done at the end, and then there was a few months went by, and then I think we somehow got a meeting together. I think he requested meeting me, just to have a chat about, just I think to see if we connected, and we sort of did, and we didn't really, nothing happened from that meeting. But then a year later I got the script for Whitehead for Field in England. Mm-hmm. And I think that had been the results of meeting me that first time and just sort of sounding me out as a person. But we have all the same sensibilities, and I think he's a great, you know, there are areas of that he knows about that I've not ever seen, and he'll suggest films and I'll go down an avenue with him of stuff that I've never seen, and same with me. I'll say, have you seen this, and he'll go and seek it out, and we sort of swap recommendations. And that's always a great, you know, it's great when you find someone who's judgment you trust, because how many hours of your life have you got left to try things out that you're not going to like? So that's why I think about box sets. I think I can't commit to this. I don't know when I'm going to die, so I don't bother watching them. But so Ben was great. We hitched up very well, and his films always have something in them that a lot of films rarely ever capture, and he always seems to capture violence, real violence, very well. And when he took me to see Kill List, he didn't give me any indication of what it was. And I watched it in a small screening room, and I just looked at him at the end, and I remember saying, why did you make that? I had the Kill List look at the end of this absolute horror of this thing that he'd done. And it was so powerful, and he made you feel something. And, you know, oftentimes you never really feel anything. You try to rack your brains as to what film you saw the night before, oftentimes. But with Ben, he's very... You don't have that feeling. I think you have an experience, and it stays with you, and it percolates, and you think about it. And this seemed like it would do the same thing again. And I was very excited to work with him under the most extraordinary situation, with in the middle of the lockdown, where it was like, I don't really believe you. He told me in April he was writing a horror, and there was a part for me. And I thought, well, that's nice, but that won't really happen. We're never going out of the house again. And then suddenly in August, it really was. And I never really dared believe it was going to happen, but we were the first, I think one of the first people to creep out into the woods and film it. Yeah. And it was like 25 of us in Henley in the middle of the woods, all tested and all living in this hotel. It was only the crew, no one else was there. So it felt the safest it could be. And it was a real triumphant experience to be back filming and think, it's possible, we can do it. It was a ray of hope, you know.
Absolutely. It was so exciting to hear that it was was underway when the news first leaked out. But I suppose you say this was extraordinary circumstances for In the Earth, but in a way, all three of the films you've made with Ben have been somewhat extraordinary. Field in England was an experimental thing, like that was going out like a troop into the field, creating that on a relatively small budget. High Rise was his first kind of larger budgeted film, I suppose, coming off the back of those earlier smaller budget one, and now back again, you're in a field on a more restricted budget. Was there a familiarity there, or had things changed over the years when you went back to work with Ben?
I think we slipped back very much into the way he works. He's quite mysterious. He doesn't really ever give you massive clarification about what if you're puzzled about where the what the story means or what someone's trajectory is, you know, I think he'll give you a few little clues, but he won't fully flesh it out because I think he likes that there's an obliqueness to it, and you're not sure yourself in a weird way. I sort of constructed a version as to why Zach is the way he is, and I think it chimed with what Ben was getting at, which was this the notion of how the human animal needs to tell itself stories to explain this world. And Zach's done this; he's gone off grid, to flee from this terrible plague-like pandemic, and his circumstances have become so extreme, and yet he's been so isolated that he's constructed almost a comfort in this sort of religious fervor that he has for nature and this bigger thing than him. And the film then, of course, becomes about that side of explaining everything to the science version. You know, we get a film that ends up in two halves in a way. It's the sort of I'm the Texas Chainsaw bit, and then there's a Quatermass bit.
Yeah,
it becomes very sort of scientific, and there's a lot of exposition about how it's happening, but it's all, you know, they're all mad. It's all mad. That's the mad thing about it. And I think Ben really wanted to explore that. But being back with him was great. He lets you try different things as an actor. He'll tell you to take it down. He'll tell you you can be bigger here. And he doesn't give you much in performance, but what he will say is just then will really steer the way you want to do it. I very early on wanted to play Zach very calmly and reasonably. You know, I thought that was a more frightening route to take than be so mad that he's just sort of, it's the law of diminishing returns. And I just thought, if there's someone so sure of and convincing and plausible in whatever he's saying, however mad it is, that's more frightening to be on the receiving end of it, because you get the feeling that he's not going to change his mind. And that's what's frightening about that kind of person, because you think, I can't persuade them with reason. And yet there's an absolute sort of steely calm under all of it.
Yeah.
And Ben wanted that kind of, I think, wanted that House of Zach.
Yeah, it's a terrific performance for people who've followed your career, particularly within the Ben Wheatley films, where Whitehead in Field in England is very much our protagonist, although does have the moment. There's a particular facial expression you pull towards the end of that film, which is etched on the inside of my brain. We'll never forget. And then in High Rise, you're part of the ensemble of the people who live in the building there, but you do have your mad moments. So there's always this thread of madness through all of the characters you played with Ben, but almost the balance, the shifts of that madness and how it's presented in facial expressions is what's different. And that's what, you know, when I was thinking about your acting and also your colleagues at Inside Number 9 and League of Gentlemen and so on, is that there is such an elasticity to your performances. You can, week in, week out, between the anthology episodes of Inside Number 9, just present a completely different face, literally. And it's...
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think I sometimes think it sort of goes unnoticed, and we're quite anonymous in that, and that only means, I think, that we're doing a good job, but I don't know that it's recognized. It's nice when anyone ever says it, because it feels like, that is a sort of achievement now, especially with however many episodes we've done of Number 9. It's like, what other facet of myself can I present? But certainly the degrees of characters that I've played with Ben Whitehead was a coward, an absolutely sort of sniveling, honorable man, but very thrust into a situation that he was sort of the Joel Fry of Field in England, thrust into a world where he was out of his depth and bumbling his way through this woods with these people that could do it better than him. And Zach is the absolute opposite. He's one with nature and is able to completely fend for himself in the throes of whatever that woods throws at him. He's managed, however much it's snapped his brain, into being able to live alongside it.
You talked about the commonality of interest that you shared with Ben when you first met him. I wonder what that was, because Ben's films can be quite eclectic, but still have these couple of qualities at the heart. He loves his blend of horror and comedy. He does like to look at some of the sinister underpinnings behind the idyllic British life or the utopian British life. And is that where you cross over, or is it something a bit more like genre-wise, like folk horror?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't even think it wasn't a phrase when we did Field in England. Maybe it just about was folk horror, but certainly some of the big sort of Mount Everests of the films that we like Wicker Man and Witchfinder General and Blood on Satan's Claw are all things that we connected with, and they're all folk horror. And it's great that I've ended up sort of doing two modern ones with Ben. He's, I don't know whether by accident or design, sort of done three now, hasn't he, with Kill List as well being one. So it was interesting that that's a trajectory he's took. I don't know whether it's absolutely folk horror that he's mining. I think it's just it's possibly the extremes of where it takes you with when you are outside. There is a weird elemental old unknowable feeling about when you're in the woods and using nature, and it just gives you a sense of something bigger than you that's there and frightening regardless of how you might want to film it in or mangle it to your story. I think you've got that. It just feels, it's the same feeling you have when you go into church. There is an awe to it that's slightly dreadful and it makes you feel small, and you feel like there's a reverence to it, and and that is what you feel when you're grappling with nature, I think. And I think he's gone part way to sort of examine that as the human animal, and how you deal with that when it is frightening. He's always talked about how he was scared of the woods when he was little, and he's very particular about what he thinks is frightening to people, and he manages to capture it, I think, very well on in film. Because you watch most horror films, and I'm impervious, having watched them since I was far too young to watch them, but the mechanics and the tropes and the feeling, you know, someone walking down a corridor in a horror film looking scared because it's dark in the corner, is, you watch it, you're not really frightened, I'm not frightened particularly, but when it's suddenly someone and they wake up in the middle of the night, they think they hear a creak on the stairs and it might be a burglar, suddenly it feels a lot more closer to home, and that becomes really scary. And I think he manages to do, I don't know whether it's always by connecting in some sort of very real way, he manages to make you feel uncomfortable in a way that a lot of films don't. And I think that's a real skill in not only thinking of it, but then also managing to somehow film it and it come across all the very, you know, what you've got to realize about filming is it doesn't just happen by accident. Every single bit of it is thought about, you know, and it's very carefully crafted. And if you can capture something, because you know in your mind what it is that's going to be scary, and this bit is going to be frightening because I'm not going to go close on that image, that person in the background. I'm going to keep very far away from it so you can't make it out. That's more chilling than being able to go close up and see it. You know, they did them brilliantly in the Ghost Stories for Christmas on the BBC, always the most terrifying things. And yet very simply filmed, a lot of them, but just, a real understanding of what is frightening about those particular M.R. James stories. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they've been bettered as far as like moments of horror where you think, why is that so horrible? And it's just some sort of capturing of a feeling that I think if you saw it in real life, it would really chill you to the bone. Mm. And so being on that journey with Ben and trying to explore that and have dialogues about that, and what would be frightening at this point and what would be funny at this point, and the scene in the earth when I'm helping Martin with his poorly foot is very much comedically as far as it as was constructed. It was very much a rhythm to it that was like telling a joke. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it felt like when we knew that, and we very much rehearsed and worked out what the best rhythm for it was as far as the most sort of hard hitting gag relief horror moment. So that fine line of comedy and horror being like the setup of a gag and then the release of a laugh was very carefully used in that moment, you know. And that was a very late addition to the script, actually, that whole scene.
Oh really? Right. And what was it like, I guess, in that scene you were playing with one of Dan Martin's great prosthetic creations there, which is another joy of Ben Wheatley's movies. Even if it's going to be a relatively grounded film, there's going to be some eye gouging or scars or something.
He refound his love of in-camera horror in this film. Yeah, there was a lot of real brilliant creations from Dan that, again, it was so thrilling to see because they were turned up on set and I thought he must have started making these a long time ago. It wasn't thrown together, you know. Yeah. But yeah, fantastic to work with that and have it in camera and
so,
capturing all that stuff.
So you said that so Ben's scared of the great outdoors and you said you're quite impervious to horror because you're watching it from quite a young age, but what were you scared of as a kid?
Oh, I think truly scared of parents dying.
Mm.
Robbers, illness, you know, all the things that you increasingly get scared of as you get older. I'm very mortal now. I'm very squeamish now. I don't like all these body horrors, Saw films and all that. I can't take it. I've been just done one with this film. But I'm very sort of, I'm not one of the sort of fright fest ones that cheer on at the heads rolling. I find it better to do more interesting, to have the more psychological horror that stays with you. I mean, Kill List was a bit of both, I suppose, but that was just something else because of the child at the end. That was what got me about that.
Oh, absolutely.
But yes, it was, I think, but then, and having said that, when I was young, I was watching the Double Bill of Horror on BBC Two, and there was a Universal, and then there was an Amicus or a Hammer at one in the morning, and I would suddenly be scared of the foxes howling because I'd just watched Oliver Reed as a werewolf, and that equally was absolutely terrifying to me, as was Freaks and as was The Old Dark House, just because of, or even Phantom of the Opera, one in the morning at the start of an Easter holiday, watching that grainy, frightening looking man. And they all just, but I was fascinated by it. I was scared, thrilled, and intrigued, and wanted to know more. And I bought the Alan Frank book, and I just, it became a real, lifelong passion, and being able to still sort of be dabbling in it myself and basically sort of remaking all my favorite bits in whatever guise has been a real thrill. I never take it for granted that I'm sort of doing the best job in the world.
I just recently found the Alan Frank horror book
in a
charity shop near me. Great find, because it's
the other one is the Dennis Gifford book as well. That's great.
Oh, right, I've got Dennis Gifford's comics book, but I've not got his his British comics book, but not his horror book. So I suppose I had a bit of an epiphany halfway through In the Earth, as most people probably do watching it, but maybe not the one that's intended, which is the way that Ben, and actually this ties in with Inside Number 9 and everything you've done, the way that you play with established genres and traditions can almost be this mind-expanding opening moment for people who may have not been exposed to those films before, you know, from, I don't know, Hitchcock to folk horror to whatever it is on Inside Number 9, but then Ben working in a lot of the world he's working in. So I suppose you've had to crack in some way the right balance of playing in that world, introducing people to that world, but not just only playing to the people who know what you're playing with. So how did you find that balance?
Yeah, that is really interesting, because that's something, a discussion we often have with writing the new Number 9s, because we'll talk about, very glibly, about things that we just assume everyone knows. Mm-hmm. Oh, it'll be a ventriloquist doll, you know, split personality thing. And we'll go, and then Steve will go, you know, loads of people might not know that. We're just dismissing it because it's like, we can't do that. That's just one of those ones, you know. And yet there are whole swathes of people that when they enter into watching an Inside Number 9, if you bumble into it thinking it's a comedy, which it is meant to be, you'll get the shock of your life, I think, because some of the more harder hitting ones and the ones that are, we do, when we try to do the horror, we try to do it properly. And then it could be very frightening for you because you might never be exposed to such things. And therefore they'll really hit home in a way that we would never think they would, because our threshold for gore or twists and turns and tropes is just, is so steeped in stuff that we've seen over and over again. And we were very careful in how we think we might be repeating ourselves or taking something from something else and using it. But then, yes, you've got to be aware of, like, there's parodying it and doing it for real, and then also doing it where you think the doing of it isn't just the doing of it for the sake of doing it. And those people that know will just think you're doing that bit from misery, but it actually, it's in its own right, you've wrapped up and you've managed to make the drama your own. Mm-hmm. And that's what's hard about going there with particular genres. I think horror films, you would instantly, but you could get it, it could be dismissed very quickly as it's another slasher in the woods film. But there is so much more to it. Yes, it is, but it's how you wrap it up. You know, it's like there's not there. You know, there are only so many stories, and you know that going in. But it's how you tell that story. You'll never run out of stories, actually. But it's just, and if, but you may well find yourself using the hidden nuts and bolts to construct it in a different way.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thanks very much to Rhys Shearsmith there, talking about, among other things, how he's scared of robbers. I think we all are, to be honest.
Aren't we all?
But let's crack on with some chat about In the Earth. So Ben Wheatley, last time we saw him was on smaller screens with Rebecca. Eleanor, are you a fan of Ben Wheatley? I think Rebecca didn't go down so well overall. Is this him bouncing back, maybe?
I think I would probably describe myself as a fan of Ben Wheatley. Yeah, definitely. I have quite high hopes for him, high expectations for him every time. He doesn't always meet them, but I still believe. Yeah, I thought Rebecca was, as I think most people agree, quite horrendous. But I do think In the Earth is kind of, if you like, a return to form, because it goes back to, I think there's something quite I think Ben Wheatley can tap into sort of very like primal fears of people, and especially when, because his films are often stay very close to the body, you know, there's lots of like sort of body horror and like anxieties that are very sort of foundational of people. And In the Earth, because it is a pandemic film, it was shot during the pandemic, and there's literally four characters total, pretty much. It sort of goes back to all this sort of, you know, he's a sort of like very bared down horror film, where the horror is, there isn't all of the like, you know, background, you know, set design and like busy stuff that was in Rebecca that I thought was quite distracting. And so instead it goes back to like the horror of like, you know, being in the woods, being alone, being with people you don't know and not knowing what their intentions are. So it goes back, I think, in some ways to his, I think maybe his best film, Kill List, which I recommend checking out. But yeah.
Mm. David, what did you make of this? Are you a fan of Wheatley's more horror leanings?
I definitely am someone who has high hopes for Ben Wheatley every time. And yeah, they haven't always been met. Like some of his sort of smaller films that were kind of, I think a lot of people found really exciting, like A Field in England, I wasn't massively taken by. I thought Rebecca was, yeah, I'm not sure like what the purpose of it is still, and what his, what the kind of reason for his involvement was. I love Kill List. I love Sightseers. High Rise as well. It didn't hit with me. And so this was actually a really nice surprise. It felt like, yeah, him returning back to his old haunts and doing something that was very, very him. You know, it was like after doing a couple of things where he's obviously having to kind of either give himself over to some source material or producers or expectations from chat, like a streamer channel or a distributor. This felt like I'm just a film for himself, like a little kind of private doodle where he could kind of do what he wanted. And I think it just sort of shows how effective he can be when he sort of let off the leash a bit and can just sort of work within his own little world. I mean, the film is like, I guess it sort of has, you know, it's quite a nice little kind of lead in to something like Resident Evil, because it is like a kind of pandemic thing about a virus. And, but then it kind of goes off in this kind of folk horror tangent as well. That's all about, you know, Satan and shrooms and you know, so very, it's, it kind of moves into this kind of psychedelic terrain, which he kind of tends to do, but does so in a way that I think is kind of like experimental, but not necessarily like alienatingly so. Like what I liked about this is that's I think something like A Field in England, like the second half of the film is like this pure kind of like strobing wig out, where you kind of just have to be like, whoa, man, this is awesome, and or not. Whereas like I think this one, he has these kind of like, you know, psychedelic interludes that like work really well within the story and actually kind of heightening the sense of fear. I mean, I think that I loved I think Joel Fry is very like he's a perfect Ben Wheatley cast member, in that he's kind of ostensibly a kind of comedy actor who's playing it straight. So it's kind of, even though, you know, a lot of awful things happen to him, it's really funny. Like, you know, like I found myself kind of laughing and wincing at the same time when he was, you know, being abused. And the main abuser is obviously Reese Shearsmith, who I think this is maybe one of his like best film performances that I've seen. And I think whenever I see him in films, there's always this sort of stigma of League of Gentlemen and his kind of like grotesque character actor thing that he does, where everything is kind of, you know, ratcheted up to 11. Whereas this, I think it's definitely a more subtle actory role. And I think Ben Wheatley kind of draws something quite unique out of him and really chilling. It's got a kind of, you know, without giving too much away, it's definitely got a kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibe to it. And I also thought that, yeah, Elora Torshia, who plays Alma, who's the female character in the film, who is kind of going into this forest with Joel Fry's Martin. They make for a kind of, yeah, she's a great addition to the cast. Really, really, really brilliant performance. And I think it's like really the performances that kind of lift this up to actually something that could have been on paper quite a kind of sort of low rent horror quickie. It gives it like there's so much more kind of gravitas and seriousness to it, and chances to invest in the characters and emotions, as they say.
Yeah, as you say, you think this might be a lockdown quickie. You know, is this Ben Wheatley doing something like Host? But it still is mostly made by the people he works with time and again. Clint Mansell doing the score, and a very interesting score for him. Lots of analog synths and white noise as it goes more cosmic towards the end. But it is great, whether it is by, you know, happenstance because of the pandemic, he didn't have access to his usual cast of actors. Those two leads are, yeah, wonderful, wonderful new additions to the Wheatley stable, I think. So, Eleanor, it very much is this sort of film of two halves, maybe the creeping tension and of the first half, and then it does go somewhere towards the end. We can't really spoil it because we can't really explain it because it's very much Ben Wheatley going psychedelic. But did you go with it?
Yes, I think I did actually. Yeah, I actually think maybe you didn't go far enough. I was kind of hoping it would go even more crazy and even more, you know, abstract and strange. And but I did like that it actually went there. I felt like it's weird because you don't really see it coming, but then when it happens, you're like, of course, like, where else could this go? Because all the characters have really strange dynamic between them. You know, they have such, each one of them, very different personalities, and they're always, you know, a bit of a mismatch. And so it just feels like a recipe for disaster. Like, there's just so much tension there. And so then that it would sort of explode in that way almost feels like on some symbolic level, sort of, it makes sense, you know? So it doesn't feel like he just ended the film with this weird thing just to be, like, random, you know? He's not just being random. Like, it does make sense, you know, thematically and all of that. And it's kind of a delight to see it progress from this to this, because it actually works, it actually makes sense, and it doesn't feel random. And yeah, as David was saying, I really think what elevates the film, or elevates, you know, what makes it really interesting is the characters that are so well written and have such, you know, they have like quirks and like little annoying personalities, especially the main lead character. He's kind of pathetic and like funny, and just, you're like, why are we caring about this guy? Like, what is going on? But then you do eventually care because you're with him, like, sort of wondering what the hell is going on. And so then that it would explode at the end like that, and that the film would sort of take over these people in that way, sort of, is kind of, yeah, beautiful and great. But I did wish it went like further even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really a return to what people love about Ben Wheatley in many ways. It is half Kill List, half A Field in England. The music is it's amazing how even when he's working on restricted budgets, there is a Ben Wheatley character to his films. You really do get a sense of the whole world of inspiration and influences that he's pulling from, be it folk horror or BBC Radiophonic Workshop, strange noises burbling in the background to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Let's put some scores on this. Eleanor, what scores would you give In the Earth?
I would say anticipation 3, because I've been burnt before. Enjoyment 4, and in retrospect, between 3 and 4, because I still think it's kind of slight, and I did hope it would go a bit further. But I didn't see it in a cinema, and I imagine in a cinema it will be even more incredible. So I actually kind of want to watch it again, because I saw it ages ago. So yeah, I guess maybe 3-4-4.
Mm-hmm. David?
Yeah, I'd probably go for like 4-4-3. It's that thing of like, even though I have been burned by quite nastily by Ben Wheatley in the past, I think he's inherently an interesting guy, and I want to see what he's doing, and he's definitely one of the kind of unique name British filmmakers out there, and he's kind of earned that mantle. And you know, he's going to do some weird stuff from time and again and make some crazy decisions that we maybe don't understand that he does, but that's fine. I saw it in the cinema, and it is a really good film to see in a cinema, just because like the idea of being kind of, you know, that sense of claustrophobia and being in the woods kind of links up quite nicely to the idea of like being in the cinema trapped, the doors are closed, the lights are out, you know, it's kind of like an extension of that environment. So yeah, it feels like it's, you know, despite the fact that it is this pandemic film, it feels that it has definitely been made for a cinema consumption.
Yeah, I'd be very keen to see it on a big screen. I'm similar to you, Eleanor. I saw it not to moan too much about the lot of the film critic, but seeing a film like this at home with your name emblazoned across it, there's one point where a character emerges from the distance in the forest and looked like he was peeking around the L in my surname. So probably not one to watch that at home unless you have a really good sound system. I'd give it 4-3-3, but I imagine if I'd seen it in cinema, I might have enjoyed it a bit more. But David, if you're interested in whatever Ben Wheatley does, you're probably going to be front row for the Meg 2. or the Tomb Raider movie or whatever he's up to next. I think whatever comes next is going to be on a much bigger scale than this.
I think, yeah, Tomb Raider's off, but Meg 2 is on.
Well, we'll have to reconvene whenever that comes out, David, and see what you make of that. So, listeners, that was In the Heights and In the Earth, both in cinemas this weekend. Let us know what you make of them at the usual channels. Up next, because another film in cinemas this weekend is Monster Hunter, the latest from Paul W.S. Anderson. We're going to go back to one of his hits, one of his biggest hits, Resident Evil Retribution. So, convoluted plotting of the Resident Evil saga. We're dropping in 3/4 of the way through at Resident Evil Retribution. Here's a bit of plot recap. The Umbrella Corporation's deadly T-virus is spreading across the globe, transforming ordinary people into legions of undead. Headed for extinction, the human race has just one hope, Alice, played by Mila Jovovich. She's on a mission, fighting her way through cities and across continents, all inside Umbrella's prime research facility. Old friends become new enemies as she battles to escape and discovers that everything that she believes may not even be true. So, David, you said if we're going to do a Resident Evil film, it has to be Retribution. Why?
Well, one Sunday a few years ago, me and my wife got really ill at the same time. And so... Instead of taking the usual medicinal route to wellness, we decided that the only cure for what ails us is to watch the entire Resident Evil saga, and so we did that, and it was a very, very enjoyable weekend, and it definitely kind of alleviated our suffering. I think we back then we both agreed that Retribution, which is like number 5 in the series, I think it was, that was the highlight. I think a lot of people dismiss the Resident Evil films. I remember because I sort of started in film criticism in kind of the early noughts, so I was kind of watching, you know, as these films were kind of coming out. You know, they were sort of coming out on my sort of weekly watch of reviewing, and you know, it almost became like a bit of a joke, a bit like some of the Saw sequels. They would always get, you know, they would get one star across the board. Everyone would just be like, "Oh God, another boring Resident Evil." It's very kind of self-serious and it's very convoluted, and it's all to do with these video games that we don't really understand. And you know, it all looks slightly cheap because it's been made in Europe and not Hollywood. And you know, I think I dismissed them then myself, but then I think they were sort of kind of appropriated and given this sort of second lease of life, and I think some sort of quite highbrow critics started to take them very seriously, and in particular the work of Paul W.S. Anderson as a kind of auteur and having this kind of seam of interest that kind of runs through his work, and particularly in the way he choreographs action scenes and writes and these kind of themes that he has, and this kind of, you know, it's almost like I think it's a kind of I think he's often described as like a post-narrative mainstream filmmaker, in that like the narratives don't make any sense, but he's aware of that, so like and he's just kind of making these kind of almost montage films, like kind of early Soviet movies, where you just get these kind of action sequence stitched together in quite sort of contrived ways, and there's something quite fun about that. And yeah, Resident Evil. Sorry, I'm cutting to the end here. So Resident Evil 5 is one in which Mila Jovovich is Alice. As so often in the series, she wakes up on the floor of a kind of research lab in a sort of state of undress, and she will then, as she so often does, put on some like latex fetish wear and pick up two massive guns, and then we'll go and fight zombies for the rest of the film. And with this one, we've got this really intriguing setup of, like, she's in the Umbrella Corporation research facility, and they have all these kind of, it's like the holodeck off of Star Trek, where they have these artificial landscapes that have been made up so they can do tests and see how the virus will spread in, like, Tokyo and Russia and Moscow and London, New York and all various sort of cities. And she ends up basically being in those test simulations and having to fight off the zombie hordes as they're being created. And it's this really fascinating kind of almost like meta text about, like, you know, cinema, artificial worlds, you know, I think on one side, it's this sort of kick-ass action film. On the other, it is like this like, it's almost a sort of like deconstruction of special effects, of CGI backdrops, of like implanting people into artificial worlds, which has basically become the norm for most mainstream cinema now. So it's almost like the kind of ironic commentary on that style of filmmaking. So that's why I think I like this film. Sorry, that was very long. I'm going to let Elena.
David, I'm so glad that you did that, because you very sort of comprehensively put out the vision behind of Paul W. Anderson's work that I wish I could see. I enjoy reading that criticism more than I do watching the films. This film, for me, I mean, I thought it was a bit more like kind of Crystal Maze almost, where she's going through all these different zones. And, you know, you do have a point that is, like, you know, there are lines where, you know, the holodeck type simulations only go so far, a couple of blocks at most, and it is commenting on the artificiality of the worlds we see on screen. Post-narrative filmmaker to me just sounds like a euphemism for the characters are thinly drawn, the story makes no sense, and there's no reason for us to be watching this. But I guess if you're along for the ride, you know, all power to you for enjoying this. Eleni, are you a fully paid up member of the vulgar auteurist school of Paul W. Anderson?
No, actually I'm not. I'm more on your team, I think. I did not. I am very aware of all those theories of how Paul W. Anderson is this auteur and very aware of what he's doing and stuff. And I can see some of that. I mean, I don't think I can deny that he's very good at doing what he does. But I just don't think there's that much to it, and I don't think that he is deconstructing cinema or the tropes of the action film so much as making very sort of, like, actually quite pleasurably, you know, simple, straightforward action films that you can watch if you're very ill, for example. You can enjoy them. But also, I just think that when I was watching Retribution yesterday, I was thinking, not in a bad way at all, that it actually does feel like one of those big, you know, blockbusters actually made for children, as opposed to, even if you watch, you know, the Fast and Furious films or any other big film like this, you know, obviously children can enjoy them. But this one actually felt like it was the logic of it and the simplicity of the story, like, you know, there's barely any, you know, there's not much like wit or anything to it, I think, which is not a problem. There's no like sarcasm, you know. It actually did feel like it was made sort of with like a sort of childlike simplicity, which is very soothing and very enjoyable and very, you know, sort of earnest and genuine, which I like. But I feel like I would enjoy more the sort of everything you were saying, David, about how it's, you know, post-story and post, you know, all of that, if it was actually like slightly more, if there was more like sort of euphoria to it, and to me it feels more like slightly, you know, dead and like expected. Even the action scenes, I just felt they were like, they were not that impressive. I like the scenes where it was one-on-one combat. I think these are absolutely amazing and really good. But otherwise, just everything about it, I just thought was like, oh, this happens and then this happens, and I wasn't really, you know, there for the ride. Like, I wasn't really enjoying that much. It just, stuff happened in front of my eyes, and I didn't really connect to it that well.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the question is like, and I think that it's been put to him in interviews where you've had interviews with him where people are asking him like, oh, you're this like sage of action cinema, and you're actually an intellectual, aren't you? And he very much kind of denies all that. So like, I think when I talk about all the sort of post narrative cinema and all that and deconstruction and stuff like that, I think it's very much like being imposed onto the text. Like, you know, whether it's intentional or not is kind of by the by. But like, but I think one interesting thing about this series is that it's like that they are like massively popular, like, and like across like six films. So like, I think the final chapter is the one after this one. Like the final chapter ended up making like $300 million. It's the biggest hit of the series. So it's like, as the series has gone on, like this, the fifth sequel is the one that has been the most successful. And it, you know, it's weird that they then chose to sort of end, you know, obviously it's called the final chapter, so they had to end it there. But they are doing, there's been a complete reboot that's happened, and there's another Resident Evil film coming out this year called Welcome to Raccoon City, which is kind of, I believe, more of a kind of close adaptation of the first computer game. So it's one of the biggest like horror franchises ever, which is kind of head spinning in a way, in that it's so largely dismissed as kind of junk by so many, yourselves included.
There's also a Netflix series on the way as well, so there's clearly such value seen in the Resident Evil name and franchise association, even though the games themselves aren't really mirrored in these films. The films have spun off in their own direction very quickly. Some characters and some like design and sort of costumes of the characters do reflect the games, but the games have very much ploughed their own furrow. And the
main character Alice who played by Mila Jovovich is made up. She's like one of them. She doesn't feature in any of the games.
But David, you're playing the latest Resident Evil, right?
Yeah, like.
So do you think the film, would you prefer the films or the games?
I mean, I think that's the thing. I think they're completely different. I mean, they're like almost completely different. I mean, like the game is like very first person, very interior, very kind of experiential, whereas the film is like rock 'em sock 'em, let's blow up, you know, blow up stuff. It's more kind of action-y. I think the films have maybe been successful in that they haven't cleaved too closely to the games, because I mean, you know, the games are the games and people like them for what they are. So like creating this completely different world for cinema was probably a wise move.
And also they start, that first film came out, you know, quite early. Like there had only been a handful of the games in the franchise released then. So, and gaming was still seen as quite a niche bit of entertainment back in the late 90s or just on the cusp of the 2000s. So I suppose they did want to have more of its own identity. I do think the Resident Evil franchise, particularly in the last two games, the new one Village and then the Resident Evil Biohazard reboot from a few years ago, are, you know, top tier horror games in a sort of way that is immediately very compelling and terrifying, but also has its moments of just wild abandon. Which I don't think we actually have that much in horror cinema at the moment, with this sort of fight between the big flashy franchises and the elevated horror. Resident Evil, the games, managed to do something that is both specifically very terrifying, but also deliver some quite self-aware humor at times too. Eleanor, I know you're a gamer, but you're not really a horror gamer, are you? Or are you?
I don't even know if I'm a gamer. I mean, I play like a couple. There are like a few games that I just play like obsessively. But I know that the trend is to, you know, like story games and like world games where you just walk around and stuff. And like, I haven't done this at all. Like, so I don't think I would really describe myself as a gamer. I'm like an old school gamer where I just play Doom. And I started playing Mortal Kombat before I watched the new film. But I did actually try playing Resident Evil, not this game, the previous one, Biohazard, but it was too scary. I just can't. I can handle horror films, but horror games, I just find them like just absolutely terrifying. Like, even if nothing is happening, you know, you walk around and once in a while there's a creature that like puts its arm through the wall where you are. Like, I just can't I just can't do it. It's too much. But maybe one day, I feel like there's like a whole, I think I would probably, if I, you know, force myself a little bit, I think I would probably come to enjoy these games very much. But I'm not there yet. But, you know, check up with me later. Maybe one day I'll be a real gamer.
Yeah, report back if you get to that stage. And already you've suggested maybe a few more video game related film clubs. I know in the past we did Super Mario Brothers. Maybe we should do Doom. We could do Mortal Kombat, another face-off with Paul W.S. Anderson. That's my favourite of his films anyway. But I think that's all we have time for this week. Eleanor Lazic, David Jenkins, thank you so much for joining me. Listeners, let us know what you think of Paul W.S. Anderson's oeuvre, as well as either of the new releases we discussed this week at the usual channels. That's at LWLies on Twitter or via email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Next week, we're back with the big franchises, Fast and Furious 9, as well as a bit of a smaller scale film, Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci in Supernova, and in Film Club, since it's getting a big nationwide re-release by the BFI, we're going back to Robert Altman's Nashville. We'll see you then.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.